Blog Talk Radio.
On a man-made lake, there's a sheet up in ice. We're unskilled skaters, cut figure eight twice. At 16, uncut, direct from the cult. Head on assault, the result, death by the bolt. In the vault, it spoke about the average lost permission that was seen by a king in a prophetic vision. Like a plane crash from a bomb blast. Special broadcast, block time with Comcast. They kept the jury quiet, and now the riot performed. While satanic man, now hanging his dorm. I swing on you fake radio personalities with Wuxia ratings. With hikes behind casualties of fire shots. With low pressure water gunplay. Instantly slap your five like it's Palm Sunday. I fashioned the first tool from the elements the earth used. And built it to a complex network of communication. You're up against a hopeless situation. I screen every vehicle through enemy observation. Swarming unpredictably. We spread terror. Increase the fog significantly. Change the era. Check my wind pattern. It's heading west. Success is freedom, but failure can mean death. Human sweat and aim shovels. Dig up debris and rubble. Permanent damage caused by the double. You, now who, cowardly urge you to merge through and think the workers that serve you, the Sonic Marvel, who just dropped the next novel. Worldwide, rap elite, more than Marvel. It's a countless amount of MCs I saved, and them same niggas wanna swindle those gifts I gave.
Moments most sacred. Both species, they lay naked in the tombs of the oasis. Think back on niggas I ate with, spend the day with, guns we play with, niggas I relate with, we broke bread. I heard through a vine, niggas work for the feds, sent out secretly to take my head. I laid back and meditate to the words they said. Skipped town 4 months in groups of dread. Had a friend tell my family I was dead. Return at the last fall of the autumn leaves. Operate the plan accordingly. In case the feds are recording me. Sign all documents. Using forgery, cause just a mere thought of me. I'm like Solomon, spoke bluntly. Told the world I'm black and comely. Howl from the grave, hunt me. The smell of death upon me. I dwell in the hills like Gandhi. Been in the presence of mad peasants and old kings who sold everything on the quest for God divine. Slept in caves to get a clear mind. Who prayed 3 times when the moon lit and when the sun rise. I met dwellers in the desert. Talked to shepherds. Been in the mouth of many leopards. Felt the death kiss of Satan's mistress. Walked through vacant districts. Performed religious. Studied pagan scriptures. Through philosophers and physicians on a cure mission. Who hardened their hearts toward the weak, sick, and afflicted. Candles lit. Gambled with a bitch. Who made me love her when I touch her. Saw paws, high claws. Bees with sweet honey in their mouth. Have bitter stingers at their tail. Walked through the chambers of death. Take a hold on to hell. Embracing her was like embracing the third well.
DC, he's been doing them since I think 19
1975, 1976. You know, I think I was 8 years old around that time, you know, reading some of the works that he's done. And he's amazing. And, of course, he's from Detroit. You know, we seem to produce a lot of good talent out of Detroit. We all know about Dwayne McDuffie, RIP, and so on and so forth. I'm going to bring him on in about 1 minute, but I want to give you a brief bio on him. So that way, once you come on, some of you have a brief understanding or somewhat of an understanding of who Arvell Jones is. You know, he's been drawing a very long time. His earliest work appeared in Marvel Comics, Marvel Premiere number 2022, January through May 1975. He was drawing the martial arts superhero of Iron Fist. I'm sure you all are familiar with Iron Fist. He will be coming to the Netflix along with Luke Cage. As a matter of fact, Arvell has drawn Luke Cage back in the day. He's drawn Thor, Iron Man, Deathlock. He co-created Misty Knight. For all of you who don't know who Misty Knight is, make sure you look her up. You can Wikipedia Misty Knight, and you'll see co-creator Arvell Jones right next to her. You know, I can go on and go on about his accomplishments in the industry, and he's still going strong to this day. You mention his name, and just guys just get happy automatically. He's just, every con in Michigan and outside of Michigan, everyone wants Arvell Jones at their show. So we're going to get him on the air right now and talk to our brother Arvell and see what he has to say about the industry and his accomplishments. Brother Arvell.
Yes, sir.
How are you doing, sir?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good.
Real good. Hey, I'm glad you were able to make it out tonight on the show.
Yeah, I am too.
Well, you know, a lot of people have been asking, you know, when were you going to come on the show? And I kept telling them, you know, I'm trying to plan it a certain way. And I know you and I had talked, and we wanted to get it closer to the time of Luke Cage when the series come out on Netflix, because by you being co-creator of the Misty Knight character, and she will be part of the Luke Cage series. I'm going to have you on here, obviously, when that happens, and I just want to get people warmed up for that.
Okay.
Now, before we get into it, I want to introduce my co-host, Ms. Kelly Alfine, and Ms. Cynthia McDonald. They're both online tonight as well. Are you guys there?
Yeah,
we're here.
Okay, great. All right. Arvell, you ready for this? You got like three people that's going to be asking a lot of questions here. You ready for that?
Oh, man. Is the spotlight on me? Is the bright lights on me?
Right. We haven't had all three of us on here in a long time.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope I can handle it.
Oh, I'm sure you can. Now, I wanted to start it off myself. Now, you know, back in the 70s, you were doing comics. You know, I was reading, you know, comics, you know, several titles that you had done back then, like the Iron Fist. You know, I was not really an Iron Fist buff, but I kind of got into the stories or whatever. What was it like? Who actually sparked your interest in drawing comics, considering the time period when you got into comics?
Oh, I don't know. When I was a kid, I really wanted to be a filmmaker. And, you know, maybe about 11 years old, I was bugging my dad to get me a film camera. Back then, you know, there were no videotapes or anything. So you had to, you know, actually go out and get film cameras. So we went to a major department store back then. It was called Hudson's at Northland. And they sold little 8mm. This is before even Super 8. This is like just 8mm film cameras. And,
right.
You know, I bugged him enough so he sort of reside himself to at least, well, let's go check him out. So we went to go check him out, and we had like the worst sales guy ever. I mean, he got there and tried to sell the whole package to my dad, you know, all at once. You know, he said, well, you're going to need the camera. Besides the camera, you're going to need a projector. You're going to need lights. You're going to need tripods. You're going to need, by the time he got done, my dad put his wallet back in his pocket and took me by the hand and said, son, let's talk about this when we get home. When we got home, he handed me a stack of comic books and some typing paper and some number two, them big old number two yellow pencils, and told me to get my story on paper. And then if it was ever good enough to, that somebody would pay money for it, you know, then he would know he had a good investment. And he would go ahead and get me all that stuff. So, you know, I kept working, and he kept denying it and denying it and denying it, saying, you got your friends to pay for a homemade comic you made. That you can't make no money like that, you know. And I kept going until I worked at Marvel in D.C. And then, I came back and I said, okay, Dad, I'm published all over the world and, and many different languages and stuff. I'm ready for my film camera. He said, well, shoot, you making enough money now, brother. Don't get your own stuff. By the way, you should pay me some rent.
Right. Wow.
So he was probably my biggest influence. Getting started. And my brother, who was also a big, comic book guy, we used to collect them together. I mean, he started the concept of buying 2 and 3 issues of everything. And my cousin, who really introduced us to Marvel, because, what my father bought me was some DC comics, some Superman, some Batman, stuff like that.
Right.
My cousin, got me the Marvel stuff, and then I was introduced to Jack Kirby. And then as far as influences were, I was,
right.
I was pumped up,
Wow, let's see, you were around during the Jack Kirby days.
Oh,
that's
well,
amazing,
you know.
Right there.
Oh, man, that was, the 60s, man.
Right, exactly.
That was all the vintage stuff. I don't want to tell you what we destroyed,
Well, I'm sure you destroyed quite a bit.
Probably worth a ton of money.
right. I'm sure at this point, wow, you're right. Now, back then, I know when you came on board with Marvel, or who did you start off with, DC or Marvel? Which one?
I started off at Marvel being Rich Buckler's assistant, who was also from Detroit. And, we used to publish a fanzine together, Rich and Jim Starlin and Al Milgram, Keith Pollard, Alfie Bradford. It was about 10 of us. And, most of those guys got into the industry. We all kind of made a pact because we would draw every weekend and work, and we actually attended like maybe the first Comic Con that were, ever created, here in Detroit. Detroit was one of the, the first places your real Comic Con was done. And we were on the committees. And helping with the organization and things like that. It was called the Detroit Triple Fans Fair. And back in those days, comics weren't cool. So, we kind of kept it. I mean, we were happy we got a small little community together, but it was like Secret Society, 101.
Right.
I mean,
right, no,
secret handshakes, passwords, and everything.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nowadays,
so,
it's cool to be into comics now. Whereas,
right,
like you say, back
yeah.
then, it was like a top secret organization. People like
looked
at you a certain way.
Yeah. And I got to a few fights about the whole thing because people just want to mess with me. But Rich, we've been working together for a while, and we kind of made a pact. And anybody that really wanted to get in, we all said we would help each other. And then once Rich got in, he started working on the Black Panther. Well, actually, even before that, he was working on an issue of Thor. And he called me and Keith and Aubrey up you know, we drove all night to New York and helped him complete an issue of Thor because he, you know, was trying to get out of town and trying to get his checks.
Mm-hmm. Hello? Hello?
I think we lost Arvell.
Well, I think he'll have to call us back. Well, needless to say, you know, Arvell is, like I say, he's been around for a very long time. He's a wonderful influence in the community. And we as artists from Detroit, you know, we been following him for a long time. And like he mentioned, you know, Detroit being, you know, like Detroit is practically the mecca of all comic book conventions. That's amazing in itself. Arvell, you back online?
Yeah,
we had lost
I don't know what happened. But, but I'm here. Yeah.
Right. Now, could you go ahead and finish explaining to us about the fan? Can you tell us about the fanzine and how it was back then?
Well, we kind of, it was a weird kind of fanzine. It was supposed to be a newsletter. It was called Fan Informer. And that started amongst us because we were collecting comics. And it was first a very local thing, you know, where you could buy comics at, what was the latest thing out, things like that. We were being fed information out of New York. Roy Thomas would actually take a phone call from us. And, you know, we would write down all the information and write it up and, you know, take some of the rumors and write them up and then speculate and all that kind of thing. And we, you know, it was printed back then, state of technology, you know, offset printing back then. And and then the more we circulated, the more we circulated, the more people we started meeting, you know, Tom Orzechowski, who became the letterer and editor for Spawn. And also worked on, in fact, the logos, I think, for Spawn, Wolverine, and, you know, and a couple of other, you know, big comics these days. He actually did those logos, and they're being used even now. Rich Buckler, who was, again, the first guy to get in. Jim Starlin, who created Thanos and Drac the Destroyer and, you know, the Guardians of the Galaxy kind of thing. He was Mr.
Right.
Cosmic. And, Keith Pollard, I guess best known for introducing the Black Cat to Spider-Man. He was the first artist to work on both the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man at the same time. And this is just at the time before X-Men really blew up. So he was working on two of Marvel's top titles, and, you know, he's a brother. And, you know, we became good friends as well. And,
I'm looking at getting him on the schedule as well, Brother Keith Pollard, if you're listening. I will be reaching out to you soon. Another brother out of Detroit. Another brother out of Detroit.
Right. Yeah,
that's just amazing in itself.
Yeah. So, you know, it was that whole. Go ahead.
So you and Keith met basically through Marvel, through working on different.
No, actually, we met working on the fanzine.
Oh, on the fanzine. Okay.
Yeah. And
so you all had like a 12-man crew on the fanzine.
Yeah. It was. You know. The more we published, the more people, you know, would show up and want to hang with us. So, you know, we had a pretty good group. And like I said, you know, Terry Austin, who used to ink, the X-Men, he was, doing work for the newsletter. It was, you know, quite a few of us, you know, that you know, just, you know, on a monthly basis, we try to put it out. You know, and we kept finding more talented artists than anything. You know, we're having a tough time getting writers. We got some pretty good writers, but but we had a lot of artists. So we kind of turned the fanzine into an art magazine and just did strips in it and sort of honed our talent. So by the time Rich got in and, you know, became, you know, an artist, you know, at Marvel, you know, he started calling us up whenever he had a problem. So me and Keith went up there and Aubrey to work on an issue of Thor. And then the next summer he called me up to help, you know, to work on the Black Panther. So he'd just been assigned to Black Panther. So I went up one summer and spent the summer doing backgrounds and, you know, whatever else I could do to help him get that project out. And by the end of the time working on that, you know, last three pages, he had to get them in and, you know, in a hurry, and he was leaving town again. So he told me, man, just finish these pages up and get them in, you know, just give them to John Vaporton, who was a production manager. So he left me three pages, which he had kind of roughed up, and I penciled them up and took them in and got caught. You know, John Vaporton looked at the pages and said, you know, Rich didn't do these. And I said, he said, did he bust me? He said, don't lie to me. I did them. And he said, oh, these are good. So, and then he said, he reached in his drawer and handed me a script.
You got your project off of that.
Yeah. That's how I got signed.
You know,
Iron Fist. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing that you worked on the Black Panther, considering, though, you know, he's going to be part of that Civil War movie that's coming up in a few weeks. You know, Captain
America.
Oh man,
Civil I'm really
War.
Excited about that.
Yeah, I am as well. I can't wait. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this: when you and Tony Isabella had hooked up, how did the concept of Misty Knight come into existence?
Really, I had created Misty Knight back when I was in high school.
Mm.
And she wasn't named Misty Knight. And when I got with Tony, we kind of, you know, Tony didn't like the idea that she was more powerful than Iron Fist. But it came down to an opportunity. Tony was talking to me about what he wanted to do with the next issue, because the first issue I was on was kind of a rush piece. And I was assigned to it, and, you know, John Vaporton said, you know, I said, when do you need this in? He says, 2 weeks ago. I was like, okay.
Oh,
so I said, well, when would you like to have it? He said, 2 weeks ago. So I said, well,
he really put the
do?
Pressure on you.
Oh, man. Yeah, he just said, you know, give me as much as you can get me as fast as you can get it, you know. So, you know, I was turning pages in. We didn't really have a lot of conversation. It was about getting it in. And so the second issue, we got a chance, me and Tony got a chance to talk and laugh about it a little bit. And he was saying he was tired of doing Iron Fist, where back in those days, the way you wrote Iron Fist was you kind of did captions identifying all of his karate moves or his kung fu moves. And he
right,
said he was
right,
tired of
that.
Doing that, and he wanted to have somebody that Iron Fist could talk to. So,
instead of Paul Bettany,
you know, you're right. Right. So in the brainstorming session, I suggested this female superhero character that I had, you know, when I was, you know, a fan. And then he said, yeah, that sounds good. And he asked me what the name was, and I told him, and he said, hey, I don't like the name. And then he asked me about the powers, and I told him about the powers. He said, she's more powerful than the lead character. We can have a character more powerful than the lead character. So
right.
We fought for a little while, and then he depowered her a little bit, and we ended up, I really wanted her in there. So, you know, I kind of accepted, you know, his changes and you know, just to get the character in. And then he renamed her. He named her Misty Knight, as in black as night. And I said, man, at least put a K in front of it. So it became
right,
Misty,
exactly, yeah.
Misty Knight with a K. You know, and
wow.
Something about, you know, this was the first, you know, that I knew of back then, the first African-American female superhero. And so
right,
I was kind of determined to try to get her in there. You know,
right.
You know, everybody think of Storm, and
right.
Storm is African, you know, so.
Right.
Right.
And, yeah.
So
and I
was
looking for, Go ahead.
So Misty Knight, was it well received by Marvel initially, or did you have a hard time?
Well, you know, talking to Tony, it was pretty easy because Tony had co-created Black Lightning for DC.
Mm, right, I remember that.
And and so he was. He said he wasn't afraid, you know, to innovate, and he was a little nervous about her being a love interest of Iron Fist, and you know, the whole integration thing
then.
Was. Yeah. He was a little concerned about that, but he, you know, I think he had resolved that he wasn't necessarily going to write it that way, that they were going to be good friends. Although, you know, later Mark Grimlaw asked me for the Bible on the character, and, and I made that suggestion. I said, well, you know, because I was trying to keep her in there, you know, I said, yeah.
Right, that makes sense.
His love interest, you know, and
right.
It would be revolutionary. I just tried to sell him on.
Yeah, at the same time, right?
Yeah, and but you know, I mean, that's kind of how it went. You know, me and Tony had some discussion about her personality, and I wanted her to be like, you know, they had back in the 70s. It was during the black exploitation period, you know,
right.
As far as movies are concerned. And that's how you want to write stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying, I don't know any people like, you know, Foxy Blunt, Foxy Brown,
Blunt.
And you know, I said, you know, most of the women I knew were, you know, and black women are, you know, strong and opinionated
right.
and smart and, you know, and quick, you know, and you just had to say the right thing, you know, so they did have that about them, but they were also
right.
to be, you know, kind and gentle and romantic, you know, and I said, mm-hmm. you know, I wanted her to be a 360 personality, you know, and we talked about it. So, you know, he agreed, and Mark Grimwald called me up and decided, hey, this is a cool character, you know, let's, you know, Marvel wants to accept the character. And we're going to make her part of the Marvel Universe. She, you know, she'll be just be in forever. And I was like, whoa, okay.
So,
it worked
right
out.
There.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting how you brought up, you know, the typical, quote-unquote, blaxploitation language that they initially wanted mm-hmm. to be used in the book because with Luke Cage, they did use that quite a bit with, you know, certain stories, you know, the Hero for Hire.
They used
it quite a bit with, you know, the piranha dude, the Cottonmouth, all that. It was straight up black exploitation in comics.
Yeah.
You know,
that was cool back in the day, Andre.
Yeah, it was cool back in the day for
them. Right.
But like you know, we didn't, you know, you really didn't know anybody that talked like that. That's only what you see on the big screen for the most part.
Right. In fact, some of it was cringeworthy to me. You know, I go into the movies, you know, and check stuff out and go, and I just kind of go, ooh, you know, I don't know if this is representing us at all. You know, this is, you know, everybody seemed really cartoony to me. And, you know, I enjoyed seeing, you know, African Americans, you know, actually standing up to the man and all that kind of stuff. I did enjoy, you know, all of that because prior to that, every time you stood up to, you know, to a Caucasian back then, you know, we were going to die in the movie. We couldn't survive.
That's true.
Right. Yeah, until
so
they created Hell Up in Harlem.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Black Caesar. No, we didn't die in those movies, you know. We was messed up in the head a little bit, but, you know, we were able to survive the Caucasian, you know.
Right.
I got a collection of black exploitation movies.
And I don't know what you guys are talking about. I walk down the street every day and stay free, sucker, just for the heck of it, you know. So.
That's funny.
Well, that's swagger. You know, media kind of influences, you know, you know, it's like art sometimes happens and then, you know, and then reality kind of mimics it. And certainly when those movies got to be popular, you know, I start seeing more and more, you know, behavior like that, you know, in real life, especially when I live in New York.
Oh yeah, because you figure most of those movies were always quote unquote based out of New York. New York was that serious population of African Americans, blacks. You know, they had a major population, and they made sure that that would be the capital of all black exploitation. And then it was over into Detroit, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and Houston. Those were the main cities that they would constantly talk about in those type of movies. But it was good that, you know, when you co-created Misty Knight, that you strayed away from that. You stayed away from that form of talking and exploitation of something that didn't even exist. You know, and like you said, we start mimicking that as opposed to that mimicking us, you know. Unrealistic.
Yeah. Well, you know, most of those movies were written and directed by, you know, by Caucasians. So, you know, that was their image of us. And, you know, I know Tony took a lot of heat back then because every character he was naming had black in the title, you know, after Black Panther. That was the first one, you know, Black Lightning, you know, Black Goliath, you know.
Right. Why does everything have to be black?
Right, why I gotta be black?
They can see we
know
black.
It's funny.
You
know?
Right.
Funny.
So that brings me to a point.
Go ahead, Kelly.
That brings me to a point that I wanted to ask. What was going on politically in the 1970s? That you feel was or was not being reflected in the comics at that time?
Well, you know, I was born here in Detroit with conservative parents, you know, both parents in the home. You know, and, you know, our life was sort of middle class. I mean, single family home, dad went to work, you know, mom was a nurse. You know, it wasn't good times. You know, we were, you know, or Sanford and Son or, you know, anything like that. It was, you know, I mean, life was pretty, you know, I know it's a sort of pariah now to say Cosby-like, but, you know, you know, our life was kind of like that, you know. And and I never saw that really being reflected in that sense. And then there was a militancy that was going on in the late 60s and early 70s because we were kind of fed up as people and being treated badly. And I think that that wasn't – I mean, that was reflected, but, you know, we were waking up to that, and it wasn't like the everyday occurrence, you know. You know, so there was a little bit of that. And and for the most part, you know, we as a people just want to be, you know, regular old Americans and, you know, live our lives and, you know, pursue a happiness kind of thing. And, you know, when I created Misty, I thought of her as a police officer, not the enemy. But, you know, you know, working a sister that that wanted to do the right thing, and but at the same time wasn't an Uncle Tom or anything like that. You know, she was going to uphold the law and think about it, and try to wheel out justice, not in a blind way, but in a just way. You know, and that was what kind of inspired me to want to create characters like that. In fact, that's kind of what kept me in comics, because even on TV back when I was growing up, you know, we had Amos and Andy in Rochester, and mm-hmm. fetch it.
And, right, like stereotypical.
That's what was being reflected, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, like buckwheat, right? Like characters
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
Things that stereotypes.
Yeah. Say. And, you know, anytime you have a strong black man, he was getting shot in the head.
So, right.
Sydney could get away with anything, but outside of Sydney, it was tough. Maybe hitting Harry Belafonte, but
right,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Sydney Poitier could get away with anything because he had a certain way to turn all of his phrases. They call him Mr. Tim. So, like, all of a sudden, like, he has like a commanding presence. So you have to pay attention. But I have a question about your transition from comics to television. I was looking up a little bit about you, and I saw that you were working. You worked on a television series in the looks like the mid '80s.
Oh, we're talking about Superboy. That was very short-lived. It was the second season of Superboy, and I was doing storyboards and then also working on a. We worked on an open for the series, but it was like I had been working in television here in Detroit at Channel 50, now known as CW 50, and you know I started there in like man what was it 79, and continued working there until 90. Doing, you know, the local TV stuff, you know, Bill Kennedy at the movies, 10 o'clock news. I did do billboards, set designs, TV guide ads, anything that had to do with artwork, you know, work done. I even drew the Oakland County serial killers and all that stuff back in the day, did courtroom sketching before they allowed cameras in the courtroom, so... That's a whole,
wow.
Yeah. That was me trying to get a little closer to that film career, which kept getting side railed because of money.
Right.
Yeah,
how did you get into? What was the opportunity for you to actually be able to get into television in that particular aspect?
Well, my brother, who was a graphic designer. Landed a job at Channel 50 as an intern 1 year, and then the next year they invited and then offered him the position, and he said he'd been offered a better position in Channel 4 here in Detroit, and so he said, but you know, my brother is just as talented, he's coming back from New York, so y'all should interview him. So they did and hired him. But you know, what got me into the Superboy thing and was, you know, my contacts from Channel 50, one of them had moved to Florida back when Florida was starting to do productions and, you know, around Disney World. And she remembered me when she got down there and Superboy was kind of happening and they were looking at how could they revise it. So they talked to DC Comics and asked them about, you know, artists or whatever, and they offered up John Byrne at the time, and then something clicked in her head that she remembered, hey, I used to work with a comic artist that worked at DC, and I was working on All-Star Sergeant at the time, and she asked about me, and they said, yeah, he's one of our artists, but we think you should hire John Byrne. And she said, oh, okay. So then she called me up and she said, You know, I'm doing this thing, Superboy, and I want to come down to Florida and, you know, bring your family. You know, you hang out at the park, and then after the park, let's do a meeting. And that's kind of how it happened. You know, I just kind of worked my way in. I won't say that I was more than John Byrne, but I certainly understood television. So. So she felt more comfortable with me for that reason, and that's what got me in.
Wow. you just have such a long, extensive career with this. I want to ask, have you ever thought about, you know, doing like your own title, whether it be television, a movie, or even a comic? Have you ever thought about doing that? Or
when, oh my really goodness, I got seriously? Probably, I probably have a ton of stuff over here of things that I've created and stories that I want to tell, and I'm just now at a point where probably the reason why you're seeing me at conventions again is, you know, I'm at a point where you know I've done enough on my career wise that I'm almost like semi retired here, and now it's time to have fun, you know, and so as I'm kind of catching up to what's going on in the industry and relating to people again and seeing what everybody's doing, you know, these ideas are coming up, and you know, I'm helping other people with their projects, but you know, for a long time I was involved in the industry only from a peripheral standpoint as a teacher and a mentor to people that wanted to get in, and you know, everybody's, I mean, we got such tools these days to do whatever.
Right.
It's hardly any excuse not to jump back in. Back when I wanted to do it in the beginning, there was a time before Milestone when Dennis Cowan was working as my assistant. I was working at DC, that me and Keith and Trevor Von Eden and a few other, you know, of the black artists were put together a package to present to Marvel that was going to be like a Milestone. And, you know, we were eventually turned down. We worked out a deal with a smaller publisher that was publishing black comics and historical books, wanted to do some superheroes, and we created a few characters and presented it to him. And we just what we didn't understand is he was on the verge of going under. And we did all this work, and then nothing really came out of it, and then he stopped publishing right behind that. And that kind of, you know, crushed us a little bit. We all packed our bags and went back to Detroit. You know, I was really supposed to only be there in New York for summer and ended up staying 4 years. My mother wanted to make sure that I graduated from college. And I was in my third year. And for the past 3 years, I was kind of BSing, you know, going to art school, you know, saying, Mom, I'm taking the classes. Like, get your butt back here and finish. So, there's been some attempts in the past, and you know, I've worked on a couple of movie projects where my concepts were going to be utilized, and you know, for one thing or another, things will fall through. So I sort of resigned myself to helping others with their dreams and using my experience for that. But, you know, I think in the near future you'll start to see some things from me. Like I said, there's so many tools these days to get stuff out.
Oh, yeah, there's plenty of it out here. You know, we're establishing more shows and everything. There's more shows in Michigan than I've ever seen since I've been doing comedy.
Right.
Don't even have to go out of state now.
Oh, yeah.
John Collell, he puts on like 4 shows a year. You know, of course, I got the Motor City Black Age of Comics. I always have to plug that in. That's going to be November the 12th this year at Wayne State University in the Student Center. So, of course, I'm looking for you to be a guest there.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. You know, you got to check with the manager and see where I'm booked.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, you know,
for
maybe
sure.
Maybe this year we got it. You got enough time.
So I'll send her a message or whatever, and we'll take it from there because I know, you know, it's like 6-7 months in advance now at this point. So
yeah.
I know your schedule, you know, we have to be on it like
mm-hmm.
right away.
Definitely.
You know, it, like I say, you've accomplished so much in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now, how did it feel, you know, with doing the Iron Fist back in the day? Because, you know, they're bringing Iron Fist back into the fold as well. And there was a lot of complaints about Iron Fist not being Asian. And I felt that, you know, I told somebody Iron Fist should stay exactly the way he was created because, after all, it was Marvel that created Iron Fist. It wasn't an Asian. They created him so they should be able to do what they want with their properties.
Well, you know, Jim Starlin created Shang-Chi. You know, the master of kung fu.
Okay.
Yeah, and Jim's from Detroit as well, and you know, so he was. That was his answer to the Iron Fist thing. You know, and I guess, you know, it was determined by sales, and back in the day, you know, before comics were cool. And black folks weren't interested, you know, and Asians weren't interested or whatever. The sales,
right.
you know, was the determining factor on which was the most popular character. So Iron Fist kind of took that title back then, and I'm not sure if he holds it to the same extent, but certainly he had a head start. And, you know, I understand that, you know, they've been talking about creating a Shang-Chi character, which has got, I guess, it would kind of counterbalance it. But even back then, I guess it was always a controversy. Me and Larry Hama, you know, kind of got on each other's case about, you know, being sellouts, so to speak. You know, I was on his case because he was writing Tarzan. Tarzan is real racist, you know. And
right.
he listened to my point and everything, and he says the man who's doing Iron Fist. Yes.
Yeah.
So I said, ooh. that hurt.
Right.
It's our dig here.
So, but we both knew that, you know, we had to make subtle changes, you know, that we couldn't rock the boat until we can, you know, spend our own money and invest in our own selves to put these products out. You know, there wasn't a whole lot that we could do to influence everybody. Plus, you know, we had to get our people on board, you know. I mean, we had to create a market first, you know. So, you know, so a lot
that's
of this changed these days. So.
Yeah, because right now, this day, that's what we're trying to do, somewhat create a market. But it seems like it's taken over 50 years to even get to this point, you know.
Oh, well,
it's amazing to me because you look at all the stories on television, you know, with Daredevil, Punisher, Luke Cage. You look at the movie industry with Batman versus Superman and all these different characters on the movies. That has opened the door in the sense of making it more acceptable to us as creators to create and be accepted by, you know, African Americans or blacks that look at our work now. Whereas before, like you said, people would look at you and you had plenty of fights back in the day. I'm sure that's not really going on as much as it did back then because the doors have been open somewhat.
Oh, yeah. You know, I tell you, back in the day, you know, when I'd go to conventions, sometimes it would only be me there.
Sure. It's, you know, but even,
everybody
would
look at me like, did you get lost?
right. Even now, you know, at those conventions now, when you multiply you by, you know what, 10, it still looks like it's just one of you there.
Yeah. Well, you know, even, you know, there's I've been a guest at convention. In fact, early this year, I was in Dallas, Texas at a convention. And, you know, I'm one of the guests, you know, one of the advertised guests, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just me. And a few of the brothers, you know, they came in and looked around and walked by me, you know, waving at me. One of the things Larry Strowman talked about, you know.
He was on the show a couple weeks ago. We talked about that. You know, but it's amazing. You know, we're going to do a show. I'm going to do a show next week or the week after about the true definition of a black nerd, or do we have it confused? But I'm not going to get all into it now because I'm with you, you know, with these black nerds that, quote-unquote, are so nerdish that they just so nerdy that they just walk by people that look like them. What really defines them is identifying with the white creators. You know, makes no sense. But we're going to be doing a show on that real soon. Arvel, I want you to let me know, are you still creating characters for universes such as Marvel, DC, or any independent companies? Are you still doing that?
Well, I haven't been up until lately. You know, I'm actually working on a title right now. It's a Kickstarter project by these guys that I was at a guest at a convention in Chicago, and they turned to me and said, you know, we're doing this, you know, because I did All-Star Squadron. They said, you know, look at our list of characters. Is there anybody you'd really like to do? You know, we'd love to have you as, you know, as an artist working on something, you know, to help develop some of our work. And I looked at the characters, and he had a Tuskegee Airman named the Bombardier.
Oh,
and I said, I want to do him. So, you know, I said, yeah, let me do him. You know, those were like, you know, back in World War II, you know, all the time I did All-Star Squadron. Yeah, that was never touched on. And I always, you know, wanted to touch on, you know, what were we doing during the war? I mean, there was a character called Amazing Man that was created, that, you know, Roy created to, you know, the show that could have heroes and, you know, back then. But his backstory was sort of sketchy. And so he was from, they created him, and Roy created him as hailing from Detroit as well. That was kind of interesting. But in fact, the first All-Star Squadron cover I did was him fighting the Ku Klux Klansmen in Detroit.
Wow.
You know, but you know, I mean, that was you know that's kind of how it was handled back then. And, you know, okay, we want to show that, you know, we're on top of it, and and that we're thinking about these issues. And to a degree, they did, you know, to the best of their, they didn't get the subtlety of it all. They didn't understand that there could be, you know, racism wasn't just about putting on a, you know, a white pointy hat, you know, spewing, you know, racist terms and things like that. They didn't get the subtlety of it, but they were trying. And I appreciated what they did do, what they were able to do, as they were trying to have primarily a white audience. So,
so I have a question,
you know,
for you, Arvel, about that. So since you were just talking about, you know, All-Star Squadron and also fighting the Ku Klux Klan, would you say, between Marvel or DC, which outlet that you worked for that you feel was more comfortable with telling the black story, or even like more so introducing the black story to a primarily white audience creatively?
I think you know, as much as I loved Marvel and everything, I think DC showed the biggest amount of face by investing in Milestone Media. And and letting those comics come to life, you know, a series of multicultural comics that was done in the 90s with Hardware, Icon, Rocket, you know, Static, and, you know, Blood Syndicate back in the day, and then later the Cuban character Cobalt and the Asian character Zombie. They put the most effort in, but it was purely you know, I mean, it was a good decision for them. They looked at it as, and they could do it, but it wasn't a whole bunch of risks for them. You know, you know, it was an experiment, and they let it run its course. And it was probably a little early because we were just, as African Americans, we were just getting into it. And then one of the biggest problems was that the distributors, you know, they had trouble getting the comic book distributed in bookstores. Why, you know, there weren't that many African-American bookstores, and there weren't that many African-Americans that felt comfortable about going in those stores and then picking up a title, you know. So the sales were always a little lower than the regular books, but they, I mean, they did go on for, you know, I guess 3 or 4 years, and they hired a lot of, you know, multicultural, you know, creators to work on those titles that went on to do some other major stuff. And so I would say DC.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I have another question. I have a few more other questions. This is Kelly. And what are the artistic differences in drawing as an artist for Marvel and DC Comics? And do you think that the movie Red Tails, when they were speaking about, when they were talking about the Tuskegee Airmen, do you think that that did them any justice?
Well, it's like that's very funny. I was looking at the other day, you know, Jackie Robinson's documentary, and and the only black producer on 42, which was the Jackie Robinson movie, was a gentleman by the name of Daryl Pryor, and you know, it's all boiling down to, you know, what these investors really want to do, you know, and how they perceive everything. I don't think that anything is told in the movies or on, you know, with these fictional stories by white writers, and, you know, even if they're African-American artists, where it really justifies it. Red Tails, Lucas, you know, did a fair job, but he really kind of glossed over the racism.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like I was looking at Jackie Robinson 42, and, you know, if I were just to go by that, it would seem like, you know, Jackie was told to be quiet and not, you know, not get upset, as they called him all kind of names, and never to challenge the white man in front of the audience. And he did that the first season, and that's what the movie depicted. But it didn't talk about what happened later. He became a civil rights leader, and that he didn't take crap on the field after his first season. And Red Tails, you know, I interviewed a couple of Tuskegee Airmen, and it was rough for them.
I can imagine. Right.
We're looking at like 2 minutes, 2 minutes left in this interview.
You have to give me a
I knew we should have had a good 2-hour show tonight. Something told me that. Time always fly by like this.
Yeah.
It's telling me now we have 90 seconds.
Okay.
He didn't say,
well, you can
I'm
get
gonna
me back in September when Luke Cage happens.
Right.
That's
what we're
going
to be looking forward to, having you on here in September. And I'm so glad you was able to come on this time around. And I want to thank my co-hosts as well, Kelly, Cynthia, for being a part of tonight's interview. And we will be looking forward to you next week or the week after as we talk about the black nerd problem. Everyone have a wonderful evening. Thanks for tuning in to the Chronicles of the Revolutionary Nerd.
All right.
On a man-made lake, there's a sheet up in ice. Where unskilled skaters cut figure eight twice. At 16, uncut, direct from the coast. Head on assault, the result, death by the bolt. In the vault, it spoke about the average lost commission that was seen by a king in a prophetic vision. Like a plane crash from a bomb blast. Special broadcast, slot time with Comcast. They kept the jury quiet and now the riot performed. While satanic man now hanging his dorm. I swing on you fake radio personalities with Wuxia ratings. With hypes behind casualties of five shots. With low pressure water gunplay. Instantly slap your five like it's Palm Sunday. I fashioned the first tool from the elements the earth used and built it to a complex network of communication. You're up against a hopeless situation. I screen every vehicle through enemy observation. Swarming unpredictably, we spread terror, increase the fog significantly, change the era. Check my wind pattern, it's heading west. Success is freedom, but failure can mean death. Human sweat and aim shovels. Dig up debris and rubble. Permanent damage caused by the double. You, now who, cowardly urge you to merge through and think the workers that serve you, the Sonic Marvel, who just dropped the next novel. Worldwide, rapidly, more than Marvel. It's a countless amount of MCs I saved, and them same niggas wanna swindle those gifts I gave.
Moments most sacred. Both species, they lay naked in the tombs of the oasis. Think back on niggas I ate with, spend the day with, guns we play with, niggas I relate with, we broke bread. I heard through a vine, niggas work for the feds, sent out secretly to take my head. I laid back and meditate to the words they said. Skip town, 4 months in goofy dress. Had a friend tell my family I was dead. Return at the last fall of the autumn leaves. Operate the plan accordingly, in case the feds are recording me. Sign all documents, using forgery, cause just a mere thought of me. I'm like Solomon, spoke bluntly, told the world I'm black and comely. Howls from the grave hunt me, the smell of death upon me. I dwell in the hills like Gandhi, been in the presence of mad peasants and old kings who sold everything on the quest of God divine. Slept in caves to get a clear mind, who prayed three times when the moon lit and when the sun rise. I met dwellers in the desert, talking shepherds, been in the mouth of many leopards, felt the death kiss of Satan's mistress, walked through vacant districts, performed religions, studied pagan scriptures, to philosophers and physicians, on a cure mission, who hardened their hearts toward the weak, sick, and afflicted, candles lit, gambled with a bitch, who made me love her, when I touch her, saw paws, high claws, bees with sweet honey in their mouth, have bitter stingers at their tail, walked through the chambers of death, take a hold on to hell, embracing her was like embracing the third well.
Underneath.